Hello and welcome to a special regular special episode of Asteroids in Exile. I'm Martin and Niv will be joining me in a few moments, but first I want to introduce you to this episode's special guest. If you participate in the monthly ritual, that is pre-ordering comics via the previous catalog, and you look beyond the featured publisher section, you might be familiar with his name. He's the artist on Action Labs, Spencer and Locke. Written by David Pepos, colored by Jason Smith, lettered by Colin Bell, and drawn by our guest, Jorge Santiago Jr. We talk about his process, the intricacies of storytelling, future plans, as well as comics we liked or did not like. And strangely, of all people, Vin Diesel, Matt Damon, and Josh Brolin. I hope you have as much fun listening to this part of our two-part interview as we had recording it, and I bid my farewell until the end credits.
This is exciting. Nice to finally meet you.
Yeah, nice to talk to you too. Although, like, I just got home like a little while ago, and while I was coming home, my first thought was, I wonder if I should just have like a crazy like Texas accent like right off the gate. be like, howdy. I'm George. Nice to meet you both. I just got home from wrangling a bunch of horses. They got up out the pen and went and ran all lickety split all over my field.
That is a very authentic Texas accent, I've got to say.
Well, I am from Texas, although
right.
I didn't get an accent out of the deal, which is kind of lame. But I'm also kind of like, I guess if it meant that I could draw well, then I guess I don't need an accent.
I think you got the more important talent out of that bargain, right?
Did you ever try to draw real fast?
I'm sorry?
I just got the joke because I thought you meant drawing and from Texas, that you're really good at a gunfight. You know, you're the first one to draw.
I can draw a gun way faster than anyone else I know, but that's about it. I've fired a few guns in my life, but like, I don't know, guns freak me out. So I try not to associate with them.
And you're based around Chicago now, or where are you based?
I live in Marietta, which is close to Atlanta. So I'm in Georgia.
Is everybody still there?
Oh, I'm here.
Okay. Niv, did we lose you, or are you still with us? Skype just froze, or my Skype just froze. So it's amazing that everything's still working, but I think we lost Niv there.
I think mine's still going.
He will come back in.
Okay. He'll find his way back.
We just keep the light on for him.
Yeah, like, I guess like doing like a podcast or doing like an interview on Skype is sort of like doing an interview in space. Like at some point, someone's just going to get, oh man. We lost Niv. We got to go back for him. He'll be fine. He's got 30 minutes of air.
We're not the Marines. We don't come back for anybody.
Yeah, he's not Mark Wahlberg. We can't come back for him. No, Matt Damon.
Was it Matt Damon?
Yeah, it's Matt Damon. Like, it's always in movies. Like, yeah, Matt Damon's always left behind. It's and like there was like a thing where they made like a how much money have they spent sending people to save Matt Damon? Like, they did it in Saving Private Ryan. They did it in Interstellar. They did it in The Martian. You know, like, it's all these movies where Matt Damon's in trouble and they have to send people out to find him.
I completely forgot that he was in Interstellar as well.
Yeah, like, he's not, I guess they wanted to keep his, like, name off of it. So it was like a surprise when he popped out. Because like, I was like, hey, it's Matt Damon.
It's good to see
you. I was wondering where he was.
And then he went apparently to Mars.
Apparently he got lost and fell into a wormhole. Ended up on some like the worst possible planet you could imagine. The one made of like ammonia and ice. Like, oh.
Yeah.
And floating in the clouds, right? Yeah.
And he came.
Oh, yeah.
And he time traveled as well. He came back to the Great Wall.
Yeah, I was going to say, but how much has Matt Damon done for the world, though, as both Jason Bourne, you know, saving China and the Great Wall?
Oh, yeah, right.
it's worth saving his life over and over again.
I guess. Well, yeah, I guess so. Although in World War II, the only reason they went to save him was because like all three of his brothers died. So it's more just like, yeah, he just got lucky, I guess. Except that every member of his family is dead. Like, I don't know.
His mom was still alive. So,
oh yeah, that's yeah.
Someone to come back to.
Yeah, because I guess like the army was like, well, we don't want to tell her that all of our kids died. It's like, oh, okay. I didn't know the military was that kind-hearted. That they were like, you know how many of these letters I have to write? If I have to write one more to the lady, I'm gonna feel real bad. Like, I don't know. That seems weird. But I did like Saving Private Ryan. I think that's probably my favorite Vin Diesel movie.
I mean, Diesel is like, Private Ryan?
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, I think he's the guy who, like, rushes out to go save somebody and he gets sniped. And then he's, like, lying in, like, it's like in a ruined city and he's just, like, sitting in lying down in the middle of the street, just, like, bleeding out. And they can't go to get him because they can't see the sniper. I think that's Vin Diesel.
Yeah, I think I remember that he was in that movie, but I haven't seen it in years.
He was
now.
In that movie. Google is our friend.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Vin Diesel was the Saving Private Ryan. That guy worked with Steven Spielberg.
He's raking in the dough right now, so don't laugh at Vin Diesel, right?
No, he's raking in the dough, but you know. With the Fast and the Furious and I'm Groot, basically.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Great.
I feel like Vin Diesel's two most beloved roles as far as like nerds go are, I think he was the voice of the Iron Giant in the Iron Giant cartoon.
He was the voice of the Iron Giant, yeah.
And he's the voice of Groot. So literally to nerds, like he is the best just like one sound person, like actor ever. Because all he does is... In Groot, he has one line. I mean, sure, he says it a bunch of different ways. And I think I saw a video where he does like the dubbed language for every for Groot in every language. So he's like, "Yo soy Groot." Like, but it's I don't know. I like to make fun of Vin Diesel, but at the same time, I'm pretty sure he could beat me up. So I think it's fair.
Yeah, he could.
Yeah.
He could. Probably beat us all three up if we gang up on him.
He's just getting more and more monstrous in every movie. Like, it's just, he's such a beast. Even next to The Rock, you know?
And they keep giving that dude spy cars. Like, come on. You get spy cars and he's buff. Yeah, he'll beat up all three of us.
Yeah.
although I would love to see that movie, though. Like, Vin Diesel versus nerds. It would just be so... It would be almost like the fight in Civil War where it's like it's 2-on-1, Cap and Bucky versus Iron Man, where he's just like, oh, I gotta keep these guys off me. Like, that's pretty much how I imagine it would be.
Except without the power armor, right? I mean, it's just Vin Diesel. He is his own armor.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Power
his flesh. Armor is car, so
just plowing through dozens of people.
He's just chasing us. It turned into a horror movie now. Now it's just like when Vin Diesel strikes back or something.
Yeah, sorry.
I was going to say, I don't know where they're going to go with like the Fast and Furious franchise from here. Like, it's just so out of reality already. I'm sure they're going to hit space. Like, it's going to be on the moon or something next time.
Yeah, but there's no friction in space.
Yeah.
There's not as much. I mean, it's going to be a zero gravity car race is what it's going to be.
They practically are anyway. Like, it's like, oh yeah, we're racing our cars on like the art, like on a glacier. It's like, yeah, that's
yeah.
Yeah. There's that scene in the trailer where The Rock like grabs a torpedo and like redirects it
like a Humvee.
I was like, I don't care how, like, I don't know. You couldn't pay me $5 to get anywhere near a torpedo. Even if you were like, look, George, we pulled out all of its explosive stuff. Look, it's over there. No, I'm not getting near it.
They pretty much left physics behind in like the third movie, I think. You know, so it was pretty early on in the franchise.
Oh yeah. Well, and like I've never, like, in all fairness, I've never seen a Fast and the Furious movie. And at first it was because like it was kind of like from a snobby thing. I was like, it's a movie about cars and racing, whatever. But then a friend of mine, Adam, he was telling me that the reason he likes them is because, like, more so than anything else, they're almost like feats of stunt, like movie making. Like, mm-hmm. as far as a special effects movie goes, like, that's where you know, stuntmen and stunt drivers and, like, you know, all of these professionals who are, like, you know, martial artists, like, they go and do these movies because they're fun movies to do, and it lets them, like, sort of, like, show their craft. And, like, when I thought of it that way, I was like, oh yeah, no, that's a really good point. Because as a person who's tried to, like, choreograph, like, a fight scene or, like, a mm-hmm. car chase, like, those things are incredibly difficult, and I'm not having to think about drivers. I'm just, like, drawing it. And so for the fact that they can make, like, 12 Fast and the Furious movies and people still dig them and they're still exciting to watch, and, like, it's like, man, like, there's something there. Although, like, it's still like, man, how many times is, like, The Rock gonna, like, rip his shirt off?
Well, the only reason he does it, I'm sure, is because shirts can't contain him anymore. But it's true, it's all about the spectacle with those movies. And I think, you know, maybe that's a good segue into, like, sort of your process and your art. So but I think that's a really good segue to start talking about, like, you know, just how you approach your art and sort of that sort of whole process around putting scenes together and the choreography and stuff.
For me, I guess I'll break it down in two ways, because, like, I'm sort of two different artists in one, because I draw and write my own comics, and then I also do art for, like, with writers. Like, for example, like, and I'll talk about this one because it's the most, like, relevant, especially to what we were talking about just now. Spencer and Locke, which is out through Action Lab right now. I worked on that with writer David Pepos and our colorist Jason Smith and our letterer Colin Bell. That one was it's a very different process for me, but pretty much the way that we did it was I would get the script and then we would break it down each page into, like, the panel layouts. Like, I would always do my version of, like, how I wanted it, and because David is very, like, exacting and very, like, because, like, he's been reading comics for a long time, so he has his, like, own ideas for, like, how the page should be structured. And so we would come together with, like, the two different layouts, and we would discuss, like, okay, like, which panel layout works best for what? Like, what, you know, as far as, like, with an action scene, you know, my thought is always, when I'm reading a script, is to think about how the page is going to read. Because mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty forgotten part of a lot of comics, is they're very they're drawn beautifully, but sometimes, like, and I think it could just be because there's, like, a miscommunication thing, because most, like, I know, like Chris Somney, and I'm sorry if I'm all over the place, but Chris Somney and a lot of artists, like, I got my master's degree in sequential art from the Savannah College of Art and Design. And when we're planning out our pages, we always place, like, where our speech bubbles are going to go, so that way there is always room for it. But I don't know if those thumbnails make it to the letterer a lot of the time. So I'm not sure, like, what's going on there. I guess when it comes to designing a page, my thought is always, like, all right, how is this going to read? And how can I, like, orient the art and orient the panels in order to help, like, visually tell the story, without you even needing to, like, to read, like, the speech bubbles. Because, like, I think more so than, because I always believe that when you're reading a comic book, your eyes are always going to go to the speech bubbles, because that's the text. That's what stands out. And, when it comes to drawing a page, you're almost like a, like the page, or like the lettering really sets up, like, the map of the journey that the art's going to be. And then how you orient the art, like, it even comes down to, like, what direction a character is facing, or mm-hmm. like, if somebody is facing right, and if we're thinking about, we read left to right in English, if somebody is facing to the right, versus somebody who's facing to the left. The person who's facing to the right, they are in, they're sort of like walking with the stream. They're walking, they're, the things that they do are sort of perceived faster because they're going along with the, like the reading order of the page. So like sometimes if you're having an argument on panel, sometimes the best way to if you have a character who is like, oh, like this is the easy way, this, you have them face right. And if you have somebody who is like blocking them or being like, I don't think that's a good idea, you'd put them mm-hmm. on the left and then have them face left because like their point is like a stopping point in the action. Like if somebody is like, I guess like I'll use like if Locke, the detective is like, okay, I need to do this, I need to rush into danger, I would draw him facing right. But then yep. if Spencer, who is his like panther compatriot, if he's mm-hmm. the one who is like, hey dude, maybe we should chill out for a second, I'll try to have him facing left, so that way it feels like there's a barrier between like the natural progression of the page. And yep. It's like it's a way to you can direct fights in what's it called, in a lot of action that way. I learned right. this from reading a lot of manga, but also from Eric Canetti. Because Eric Canetti, he came to SCAD a few times and did some talks, and I got a lot of portfolio reviews from him mm-hmm. over the years. Eric Canetti was the artist on Run, Love, Kill, and mm-hmm. he did Enter the Mandarin for Marvel. But he was also a storyboard artist for Disney on, Tron Uprising, the TV show?
Right, yeah.
And one of the things he talked about was because we in English, we see progression is left to right. He talked about when he was doing like a chase scene with like the Tron motorbikes on a highway, when the heroes were chasing down this like vehicle and they were like speedily making their way through traffic, they would always be traveling left to right, like top to bottom. But as soon as like the vehicle that they were chasing like started to attack them and like shoot things at them, then the highway sort of like makes a quick turn, and now they're heading uphill. Like visually, they're heading up towards the top, like left corner of the screen, and they're having to like dodge missiles or dodge lasers and things like that. And so that's where those are the things that I always try to plan out when I'm figuring out my pages, is just how can I orient the art in order to help the story move along, and how can I compose things to make them as like clear as possible, even without like dialogue or color. Because like this is something like I had my first ever like comic book signing on the 12th, which was awesome. But it was also it was really humbling. I loved it a lot. But one of the things that people were saying is they thought that my artwork stood out really well in black and white.
Yeah.
And to me, like that's the best like compliment that I could get, is that, you know, it's easy to read even without the speech bubbles and without the color. And like I'm not saying that like those are taking away anything from the book, like they're certainly not. It's just that I want to make sure that I did the best that I could do to make like my portion of the comic like as strong as possible. And so like because like as the artist, I'm not just drawing characters, I'm the one who's like conveying the story. Like mm-hmm. I want to make sure that I can use as many possible techniques in telling the story. So I've been rambling for a while, I apologize.
No, it's
amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool to hear the process. I mean, even the what you're mentioning before about sort of having the obstacle to the story progression come in from the right. So do you think about that in terms of the panel makeup, or like in terms of the pages as a whole, or is it a combination of both? And that might be a little bit too detailed as a question, but yeah, I'm just trying to get an understanding of how do you sort of put it together in your mind? Do you think in terms of the pages or the individual panels?
I have to think of them as the page, because this is something that like I've learned a lot from watching movies and reading manga again, because like when I was in school, the professors would say, like, you know, when you're telling a story, like, you don't need to like have you know, like sometimes like you'll have panels that are, they're not squared or rectangled, they're like on they're like angled and such. And I remember when they were saying that, because whenever I did it, it was always just because I thought it was cool. But then once I started looking at comics where like they were using it properly, like Becky Cloonan is like a really good example. Like in her book The Mire, there's a scene where there's a scene where this there's this like mummified woman who's got like a dagger like stuck in her chest.
Yeah.
And the panel where you see her, it's like it's wider at the top, and then it like sort of funnels down, and then you see the knife like stuck in her chest. And so when I started thinking about it, is it like the to me, like when you have a panel doing something like that, it's like you're visually panning through through a scene. Like it's sort of like the camera is like pulling back or pushing forward. Like it helps me to think about my storytelling as like almost like a movie. Because my imagination is, it works in motion. I don't see things as like, as still images in my head. So, it helps me to think, I feel more like a cinematographer, you know, like, all right, the camera's going to go here and I have to move it here in order for this scene to work. But, since the panels have to be drawn and I want everything to sort of interlock on the page, especially if like there's a scene, I'm just grabbing my Spencer and Locke pages just to see if there's anything like that in here that I could use as like here's an example. And of course I'm not really seeing any.
It's always the case when you try to find it on short notice, it never shows up.
Yeah. Right? Well, and like, so, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, I was gonna ask, going back to this cinematic theme you were going on before, like, so that seems to be a bit of a trend recently with the cinematic style coming more and more into the comic medium. Do you see that as well? Like, is that changing in the industry? And is that something you're aware of in terms of trying to bring it back to what comics can do better than movies and sort of the way movies compose their scenes? And how aware are you of that as you are putting your story together?
I guess it depends on the creator, really. Like I find that a lot of the times the artists that are most like incorporating those types of like film inspired storytelling techniques, they don't tend to be from America. They tend to be from abroad. Like Greg Tokini is an artist that I feel like, oh, he uses a lot of like visual imagery that comes from movies. Like a lot of his shots are very like, oh, I'm going to put this camera like on, I think somebody called it a Dutch angle. I'm not sure if that's the right term for it, but he always has these shots where he puts the camera like really high up, but like on a, like you can see like the entire layout of a room, but it's funneling like straight down. And there are these like, these brilliantly drawn segments where you can see so much of the character, like you can see like their entire body, but you can also at the same time see like the entire room that they're a part of. So it's like you get that perfect blend of like character building and also like world building. And I'm not that good yet as a lot of those artists, so that one can be tricky. I definitely do. And the thing about comics, and this is cool, because this sort of like brings into like my thesis, because my thesis was about panel design and how that can like influence storytelling just as much as the art. And I went through a bunch of comics that I was reading, and I was finding that it's definitely a trait that you find in artists that are older, or artists who are more because in this day and age where there's a lot of comics that sort of, they have to come out quickly, sometimes the easiest thing to draw is the best thing to draw. Like, okay, I'll draw this because this book has to get to print and I need it off. And so like I had it sort of lucky because when Action Lab picked up Spencer and Locke, we had a month and like a, or no, we had a year and a couple of months to finish like all four issues. So I got to take my time and plan them out. Like the longest stage of making them was the planning out, going through the script and thumbnailing and re-thumbnailing and figuring out the best sequence. And then the drawing the pages part was like the easiest portion, right. Like took the least amount of time. Well, I guess like in terms of like the full time, I think we spent more time planning out the pages more so than anything else. But go ahead.
Sorry. I wanted to ask, like, is that the more collaborative part of it, right? So you're actually working with the writer at that stage to actually plan out the story, the pages, and how it's all going to fit together. And then you would then work on the art after that stage. And it's right. That's kind of more the solo part of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, I know that in, especially like with Marvel, like there's the Matt Fraction, David, is it Aja or Aha?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure. So I'm just going to go with Aja, because if I say Aha, I might start singing Take On Me. And so like their Hawkeye, their take on Hawkeye, I think is one of the examples of, you know, where like writer and artist like blend together and like they really told a story that it's one of those things where because they work well together and they're not standing in each other's way, like they can I feel like the product is a lot stronger. But if I had a writer who wasn't as invested in what the interiors would look like, then it probably would have been a pretty different comic. I guess like in my experience, it's very interesting because like David's the first writer that I've worked with, because up until him, I'd always worked alone. Like even when I did like in school, we would get scripts, but I wasn't in contact with the writer. It was always like, oh, here's a script from B. Claymore. You guys should draw this now. That's your assignment. It's like, okay. But like, I couldn't send him a message and be like, hey, what did you want in this panel? Like, what were you thinking as far as like how you wanted this? Like, what is the most important information here? And so I'm doubling back to the question. I think that I guess like cinematic storytelling will sort of depend on the artist. Like personally, I think that it makes the comics more immersive. Because I think that it's a very more so than anything else. Like I think like when people read comics, like they want to sort of, it's almost like escapism. It's not just escapism, but like it's like you want to be thrown into a world where these characters exist, be they superheroes or a detective solving a murder. You know, like it's sort of like when you go watch a movie, you want to be in that world. Like that's why the lights, like you want to be, you're watching, you're a witness to this world that's unfolding in front of you. And I think that like if with a lot of comics, just because like they don't have like the time to like really put like that care into it, like it can be kind of detrimental. But like European comics, like I don't have like the greatest of experience with them, but like the ones that I've read and what I know about like the European comic industry is that like they give their artists a lot of time, or at least a lot more time comparatively, to compose the page and to make it beautiful, you know, like, and like really, I mean, like every time you read like a page of Black Sad, you're like, whoa, look at this world that I could, like, you could almost walk into it. It feels so like, look so real and warm and stuff. But like, I think like in American comics, there would probably need to be like some more time given to the artists in order to make things like that immersive. Because I think a lot of artists would need to be trained in how to do it, because it's a very deceptive, it's a very easy to overlook aspect of making comics, is the storytelling part of it. And even when people try things out, it doesn't always work the right way. It's sort of like, oh, you've seen a lot of movies and you want to make a movie, but the first time you pick up a camera and you try to film it, like that's difficult. Getting it in the right spot, knowing what the right lighting is, like there's a lot of thought that goes into what you see on this frame, or in this case on the page, that if you don't know, then it's easy, then when it's missing, you can feel it.
Yeah.
Like one of the comics I remember talking about was, there was this like Vertigo book like a few years ago. It was about this like this girl that she was like a member of this famous family, and I think that she became like a I don't know, but in the way I say it almost sounds like it's Mother Panic, but it's not that. It was like, I don't know, there was like this like gothic horror thing happening.
Oh, the Dan Abnett thing, the vampire book, the Neutered Audience.
You know, I don't know. I would really need to look at it, because I don't want to say the name if I don't know who it is. Yeah. And I also don't want to like denigrate the artist for like the work that they did, but it's just like so there's a scene where like I think this lady is she's like really badly shot, and she goes into a doctor's like they're operating on her, and there's this scene where like a lot of different like scenes from her life that were traumatic are drawn like as if in shards of glass that are circling the page.
Right.
Like drawing wise, it's a very impressive like illustration, but in terms of storytelling, like it's sort of like, all right, where do I begin on this page? Like where do I start, and where am I supposed to go? Like it's this very sort of not cobbled, but it's very like almost like piecemeal method of reading the page. And I guess maybe it was made with that effect in mind, like you're not supposed to read it and you're supposed to read it oriented. But mm-hmm. when you compare that to sort of like how Frank Quitely puts together a page, like I was looking at like We Three, and like in We Three, he was always thinking about even when it gets weird, and We Three is really weird, there's always a point where it's you know where you're supposed to go. And even when he's like filling the page with like dozens of tiny panels for like that scene where they're escaping from the from like the facility, like the weapon animals, like, you know, you still get this sense of like, oh, okay, I understand that this is hectic, but I also know where to read.
Yeah.
Because the biggest trick in making comics is telling your story, but without losing the audience. Because like I'm very guilty of like I'll pick up a book or I'll watch something on TV, and if I'm not invested in like 5 minutes, I get very like, my time is valuable. I can't be bothered. I need to get out of here. Yeah. And you know, cause like people's time is valuable, you know, like if somebody gets home from work and they have like an hour to read a comic, like I want to make sure that if they pick up one of my books, it's something that they can drop into, and that it's like, oh, okay, I'm never confusing them. Like I did this like sort of comic experiment when I was at SCAD. Mm-hmm. Do you guys remember it wasn't that far off, but it was like, I think it was issue 7 of the Scott Snyder, Greg Capullo Batman. Yeah, it was the one where the book rotated.
That was the Court of Owls story, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember when I read it, I was like, whoa, this is so cool, the way the book just turned. But then like I started reading it and I was like, wait, there was a point where I didn't know how I was supposed to read. Cause like you're supposed to read the book like backwards or something. Or no, it's like you read the pages normally, but the page order is backwards. Like you have to read the right page first, but you're reading it like left to right and top to bottom. And then I think you go to the next one, which is like on the left. And I remember that felt really weird when I was reading it. So even though like it was a great way of showing like, oh, hey, this is Batman like going crazy. And not only is he going crazy, but you can feel it. You can see and feel the disorientation that he is feeling, like as all of these horrible things are happening to him. It was such a great idea. So I wanted to try something like it, but I wanted to see if I could like ease the reader into it. So I did a book called The Caverns, which was like, it was part of my thesis. It was about a detective who goes looking for a missing child. Cause I was reading a lot of Lovecraft at the time. This kid went into a house, like an abandoned home, like playing hide and seek with their friends. And even though like all the other kids left, this one kid didn't. And like police have been searching and they have no idea where this child went. And so this detective goes into the house and he finds this like this passageway in the second floor that leads into like this cavern. And at first he doesn't know what to make of it, but he decides that if he's going to find the kid, he has to check this area. So in the book, there's a 2-page spread where it's him entering the cavern and getting like starting to lose it a bit. Like he's starting to be like he can't remember how long he's been down there. Like between 3 panels, like he grows like almost a full beard because there's no daylight. He has no sense of like, oh, how long have I been here? Time, and yeah. In order to sort of drive that home and also play with the Greg Capullo technique, I started rotating the panels. So that way, when you're reading it, you're holding the book out in front of you left to right. But then by the time you get to the bottom of the page, you're holding the book. So it's the pages are top and bottom. Yeah, and so like whenever I'd go to shows, I would have this book, and I would I'd be like, oh, here, this is my comic experiment. I tried something crazy with it, and it was really cool watching people read it, and then just like naturally start to rotate the book, and then reading it that way. And so the like that 2-page spread was like my trick to see if I could ease somebody into that same type of panel rotation or page rotation. I'm sorry. But not like lose them in it, because they would never comment like, oh, I see what you're doing here. They would always finish the book and then be like, oh, that was cool. I like that.
Right.
Kind of thing. And so and like I can send you some like you guys do show notes or things like that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can send you some pages from all the stuff I'm talking about. So like hopefully it'll be a little bit easier for people to see. And
yeah,
like
that'd be great.
Yeah, that would be awesome. And yeah. Did people comment on your color work in the cavern as well? Because I read it yesterday, and I remember when you turn the comic book, it seems like the scenes are getting a bit brighter when he enters the cavern, as to signal that he's near his goal, so to say.
Mm-hmm.
Did people comment on that as well, or was that a deliberate choice that you made? Because it struck me as weird that I say, oh, it's getting brighter in this as he reaches his goal.
Oh yeah, and so here's another like little like a long story explaining that. So at the time, this is when the fifth Beatle had come out, the Andrew Robinson book, and I love Andrew Robinson's work because that guy is like a virtuoso of. Not just like character storytelling, but also just like in terms of his technique, like that guy, you could give that dude like a stick and some mud and he would make like a beautiful comic page. And so like looking at his art, and especially in the fifth Beatle, like there's a lot of pages where sometimes it's in watercolor, sometimes it's in marker, sometimes it's like it's digital. And so I wanted to try doing something like that, but have like a story reason for it. So, in the caverns, like all of the scenes that take place on Earth are in they're rendered in Copic marker. Mm-hmm. It's Copic markers, and I was using a colored pencils for line art, and I use those same colored pencils throughout. But as soon as you get into the caverns, I switched materials. I'm using watercolors, and I was using a paper that has like a more cream tone to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like all of the things on Earth are on this like bright white paper with like a lot of marker rendering, and it's really dirty and it gets really dark very quickly because that's all markers can do. But then with the watercolors, since they're transparent, like they stay vibrant and they stay light, but the like that warmth from the paper is really so I wanted to have my art materials tell the story in the same way that like I was telling the story, not just with the characters, but with like the page rotation and all of the other like just like storytelling tricks that I was trying out in my thesis.
And it works amazing. I talked to Kevin a lot because you wrote on Instagram that you weren't sure if people would dig it. I was really interested to see what it's about.
Yeah, cool. Thank you. Like,
no.
It's one of those. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you for providing me with a copy.
Oh, no problem. Like I like you've been like legit like one of the coolest people I've met since like I've because like I moved out here to Georgia to go to school. And like, I made a lot of friends, but you've definitely been like one of the coolest people and like most supportive people that I've. So no, thank you. I owe you one.
No. You made my whole family cry on Christmas. I owe you one. Tears of joy. I have to add.
No, I would take it if I made like a whole. Well, no, I'd probably feel bad if I made your family cry.
They were happy tears, though.
Yeah,
the best tears. Like, yeah. I love when I can watch a movie or like read a comic and like I want to cry at the end of it. I'm like, this is good. It's got me right in the heart. Like that's what I want. And so like that's what I'll always endeavor to do with my comics is like to tell a story and then hopefully I can pull some tears like out of you and like and make you care. Like I think that's the like more so than anything else. Like, cause I watch a lot of movies and I read a lot of stuff and like, art is very subjective and certain tools work for certain people or not tools. Like, certain like character moments work for certain people and things like that. And it's really easy for like a movie to be not very well made, or not well made, but like technically it can be like very, like shallow or, mm-hmm. but like if a movie can make you care about the characters, then I think like in my mind, like they've done something good. Like they've gotten that part right. And like, so whenever I see something that makes me cry, I always like have to note it. Cause I'm always like, you did it. Awesome.
Yeah.
I give them like the Terminator 2, like thumbs up as I enter into the sad,
sad lava. I love it. That's great. I mean, so that's a great segue into like, what are those, whether it's movies or comics that have actually inspired you and like made you want to do this every day, you know?
Okay. So the first comic that I like, I guess like when I was a kid, my mom got me the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, like the Eastman and Laird stuff. Mm-hmm. Because she was like, oh, he loves the turtles. He'll love, like, here's a comic. Perfect. But she didn't check it. Mm-hmm. And like, that's the one where like the turtles kill the Shredder on like the first time they meet him, you know, like that kind of thing. Like, oh, I'm sorry for spoiling a book. Like, it's like 30 years old. But like, and so I remember that being like the first book that I read that I actually remember like vividly. And then I remember drawing like a lot, but I was never really into comics as much after that, just because like, I feel that in the 90s, like comics were almost like impossible to get into. They were so, and I think part of it was just because like today you can find back issues like nobody's business. But like back then, like if you were starting on, oh, I want to read Spider-Man, well, where do you start? And so I sort of fell away from comics until I was in high school when a friend of mine showed me a manga for the first time. And like it like awakened this like weird addict inside me. The book was Ranma One Half. Like, are you familiar with like the storyline of Ranma One Half?
Yeah, a great book to start the edition with.
Yeah, it's and like because it especially at the start, like it's very jokey. But at the time, I didn't know that it was like a comedy comic. Like the first two volumes of it are almost just like slapstick martial arts, which I was like, okay, that sounds good, but She let me look at the first like chapter or so of it. She was like, do you want to borrow it? And I said, nah, I'm good. And I spent the rest of the day being like, oh, what happens next? I don't have her number. I can't even call her and be like, hey, can you tell me like where I can find that? Or can I borrow the book actually? And so at like the age of like 16, I was like, wait, I used to draw all the time. I know I'll draw my own comics. And then it's been, so I was like 16 when that happened. I'm 31 now. Like almost half my life I've spent like chasing this like comic dream of just like drawing my own stuff. And even though I didn't think I'd make a career out of it at first, mm-hmm. once like I started really like analyzing it and figuring it out, then I was like, oh, okay, cool. I can totally make this work. And so after like self-publishing for a while, I'm like, okay, cool. Now I have a book in comic book shops. Now all I have to do is just do this forever until I die. And that's the tricky part. But to go back to your question, because I had to tell my origin story, because this is like a comic book movie. I think the book that really broke my heart and made me want to like tell stories that were, because like I've up until I guess sort of recently, I was always just drawing action comics because I was like, oh, action comics are fun. It's cool to draw like people fighting and like ripping mm-hmm. each other in half and stuff like that. And like when you're reading manga, like that's most of what you see. I mean, yeah. And even when you go to the comic book shop, like it's mostly fighting, you know, like it's never like, this is Spider-Man and like on a day off, you know, like, oh, yeah. he goes to the movies and he has to go get like anti-itch cream or something. Like it's never, it's never like real stuff. And so I read this one manga called Not Simple by Natsume Ono. And this book was the first time like I ever read something that made me realize like, this is how a story is told. And like, this is how you can use these techniques and your art, and you can like break a person down, like almost like at a molecular level, and you can make them cry. And so I read that book, and like the storytelling in it is perfect. Like the story is like, if I was to tell you like what it is, it's very sort of like melodramatic almost. But when you're reading it and you're sort of taking your time and looking at the panels and stuff, like it made me so sad. Like when I read it and I was like, this is what, like, I was like, this is the new pinnacle of what I aspire to. And so at this point, I think that book is like out of print, but like I can grab another one that made me cry recently. It was called The God's Lie by Kaori Ozaki.
Right.
Like I don't know if you've read it, and I don't want to spoil too much of it, but it's a story about this this boy. He's a sixth grader who's living with his mom, and he lies about going to this like soccer camp because he's not having fun at it because like this new coach is kind of a jerk, and so he doesn't know, like he's supposed to be at this camp for like a month and he doesn't know what to do. And he ends up staying with this like classmate of his who is it's her and her little brother. And they've got sort of like a sort of rundown house. And the girl's parents are also like not there. Like her dad he's out like on a fishing boat, like catching crabs. And mm-hmm. the mother is like, I don't know if she's just out of the picture or if she's dead. And so it's like this like summer story where these two kids or these three kids are sort of just like living under the same roof and just sort of dealing with being young and being, you know, like you're feeling pressure from your parents and feeling pressure from like this. I mean, like the girl whose name is Ryo, like she's so grown up for her age. Like she's because like they only have so much money because the dad isn't there. So they have to ration it out. And they're like, okay, like this is what we can afford to make. And if we're feeding three people, like this is what we need to do. And it's like, it's such like a, it's a great story as far as like a coming of age type tale. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like it has parts in it where just like I wanted to like throw the book at the wall. Cause like there were characters that I hated so much, but like I couldn't right. do it. Cause like there were these kids who were just like, they're just kids. Like they shouldn't have to go through this stuff. And that's yeah. how I know I'm in a, like in a good space when a comic can make me like to care enough about some kids that I'm just like, oh man, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah.
It's sort of like Grave of the Fireflies where like, it's so sad. Oh, it's like, yeah. no, this is too, no, I can't handle this. So like as far as like comics go, there's that. I'm trying to think of like other comics I've read that like really sort of like I guess turned on like the tear faucet. Cause like, I read a lot of stuff. I know like in terms of like TV shows, there's an anime called cause I'm a giant nerd. Like I love watching cartoons, but what was it? There's this show called Erased. It's on, I know it's on Crunchyroll. Like that show like broke me, even though it's like it's sort of a sci-fi story. Like there's one sci-fi conceit in it mm-hmm. and they don't really explain like how it works or where it came from, but just like the story itself is it just like, it's so, I don't know. It's weird. Like if I was to explain it to you, it would probably seem kind of wacky, but it's about this, this dude who is like, he works, I guess like he sort of like squandered his youth sort of, he's like mid-20s, I guess. I think he's trying to do comics and like, it's not going so well for him. So he's delivering pizza as like a side gig, but he has this like weird ability where, whenever something bad is about to happen, he goes through this experience called revival where, he'll jump sort of backwards in time, like a few minutes. Mm-hmm. And every time this happens, he's recognized, like this has happened to him since he was a kid. And he recognizes that when this happens, something bad is about to happen. So he's gotten used to it. So he starts to like look and try to find what's wrong, what's standing out, like, you know, where's the bad coming from? And like in the first one that they encounter, just to like give you an example, is he's driving down the street like in his like pizza mobile, or it's like a motorcycle thing, and he passes by like a kid crossing a road. He passes by a bunch of cars. There's like a truck like with a driver in it that's like passing. It's like a big, like a almost like a semi, like not quite that big, but something like that. And on the second time through, after the revival happens, he notices that the driver of the semi is asleep at the wheel. And so he does like a quick turnaround, and he manages to like sort of get up into the cab of the thing slightly and like pull the wheel of the truck so it doesn't run over this kid who's crossing the road. And because of that, he gets hurt, and his mom shows up to take care of him. And what ends up happening is like the revival happens again, like in the same episode. He and his mom like thwart like a child kidnapping. They end up sort of doing some looking, because when he was a kid, two of his classmates died, and it was really traumatic for him. So he and his mom start like looking into it some more. And then he comes home from work one day and finds his mom's been like stabbed, and like she's bleeding out like in his apartment. Then the cops arrive, and he goes through revival again. But instead of it being like a few minutes, he goes back like 20 years. And now he's like a child, like with the mind of an adult. And he's trying to like figure out like, okay, whoever killed my mom is probably the person who killed my classmates. So if I can figure out who did it and stop them here, maybe I can save not just my classmates, but also my mom from being killed in the future. So it's this weird, like, to explain it like that, it's kind of funky. But like when you're watching it and you're just like, oh man, I can't handle this, like all this bad stuff happening to these kids. But at the same time, like it's good stuff. Like I don't know. I like it when a show can make me cry. But I'm also kind of crap. Like I'm not gonna lie, I cried twice in Logan.
Logan was emotionally it was a pretty tough movie to get through emotionally, let me tell you.
Yeah, like especially like that last part, like I don't know how much you guys have talked about it, and like I don't want to spoil it, but like there's this scene with him and Laura, and like, and she says something, and it's like it's right at the end. Like, yeah, that killed me. I was like, I was sitting in the theater, like wiping away tears, but trying not to like make it super obvious to the people around me that I was sitting there bawling, like during a superhero movie. And even talking about it now, I'm starting to like to tear up. So
choke up. Yeah.
So we should drop it. We should talk about something else.
Let's go back to Vin Diesel.
Vin Diesel. He's never made me cry.
Save us, Vin Diesel.
Vin Diesel, save me from emotions. And then he shows up and he's like, hey, what's up? And I'm like, oh, perfect.
No, he's gonna be, it's all about family. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't have friends. I have family.
Yeah, exactly.
They said family like 18 times during that trailer. What about family? And then he kisses Charlize Theron, I think that's who that was.
Yeah.
She's in the movie as well.
Wait, what was that? Sorry, man.
Charlize Theron is in the Fast and the Furious.
she's the villain.
Okay. Yeah, she's the villain of the next one.
I have to start watching those movies at some point.
Yeah, because Martin and I haven't spoken in the last couple of weeks. I actually saw it last week. I thought it was good escapist fun, you know?
Yeah. Okay, cool. So it's out. I may just go see it just because, like, I haven't seen one yet, and this seems like, it's in theaters. Like, if they can get me with this one, then, like, well, maybe I'll go back and rewatch some of the older ones. Is there a lot of lore? Like, am I going to know, like...
Yeah, they're fast and loose with the lore. So, I mean, you could watch it because all these characters have been in previous ones, but they all kind of swap around anyway. So I don't think it's going to be that confusing for you.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to check it out because, like, I've been hankering to see a movie for a while. But, like, I haven't, like, we saw Logan. I saw it first by myself, and then I watched it again, like, with my roommates. And it was really great, just sort of like at all the scenes, like turning to the left and watching my roommates like wiping away tears. And
yeah,
that's how you know it's good. But then, like, we saw Ghost in the Shell, and that was like the opposite kind of kind of experience. Because, like, so, I don't know.
What was your thought on that? I mean, it's. I haven't seen it, and I don't think Martin has either.
I guess I won't see it because, you know, we have the anime anyway, and the manga.
Yeah, and, like, so I guess, like, my impression of it is that it's a movie that nobody on the film team wanted to make or that they cared. Like, years ago, I watched the second Twilight movie, not because I wanted to watch it, but because, like, a friend of mine was like, George, let's go see it. And when you're watching a movie and you don't care about what's happening, you can sort of just look and see, like, storytelling techniques, you know, like, oh, like, this is how they're conveying sadness, 'cause, like, the camera moves and stuff like that. Like, everyone in Ghost in the Shell, like, did their job, but it's such, like, a, like, no pun intended, it's such a soulless movie. Like, it's weird that they even made it in the first place, because, like when you have things like Deadpool is like a labor of love between, like, amongst, like, a lot of people who really wanted to make this movie. I think when you watch Deadpool, like, Deadpool's not perfect, but I think what you feel most is the enthusiasm and the love poured into it by
passion.
You can hear the high fives they're giving each other off camera.
it's great. But, like, in Ghost in the Shell, like, there's none of that. Like, it's such, like, a clinical, cold, like, by the books movie, which, like, I guess is fine because, like, I guess it sort of fits in with, like, the, like, Ghost in the Shell, like, kind of thing. Like, because, like, even the original anime, like, the major is she's very emotionless. Like, that's sort of like what they're talking about. You see, you know, like, how removed from humanity can you become before you stop being a human? Well, like, in this movie, it feels like there was not really a whole lot of humanity to begin with. And like a lot of the scenes, like, the best scenes in the movie, I feel like were done better in the anime. Like, more so than the manga, because, like, the manga has a lot more, like, it's almost, like, slapstickish.
Yeah.
You know, like, the
Shiro brand of humor.
Yeah. Like, it's very, like, 80s style humor, where it's, like, the characters are goofy and stuff. Like, the movie, especially the first movie, is so, what's his name? Mamoru Oshii. Like, it's so his flavor. Like, that's his thing. That it's almost like you have to say, like, oh, there's Shiro's Ghost in the Shell and Mamoru Oshii's Ghost in the Shell. I'm really surprised that they didn't, like, because at the start when they do, like, the credit scene, like, or I guess, like, during, like, the birth of the cyborg scene, like, they said based on the comics by Masamune Shiro. I'm surprised they didn't say, like, based on the anime from Mamoru Oshii, because that's technically more correct. Like, there are scenes that are just straight up lifted from the comic, like for example, the birth of the cyborg, but even then, like, it's not as impactful. And and even, like, in the movie, like, for example, the, you know, there's that the song that they play, like, that haunting, like, choir. during that opening part.
Yeah.
Like that, they don't play that song at all in the movie until the credits, and then they start playing it. Like, I don't even remember what the music of the movie sounded like. It, I don't know. It was just such like a forgettable experience for me. I think like, I don't know. Like it was just such like a, I thought that, okay, they made Ghost in the Shell into a movie. Like somebody must have been like, look, I love this movie. And this comic, I'm going to turn it into a movie and it's going to be rad. But like, they didn't really do that. Like, I don't know. I couldn't hear the high fives. That's how I know it wasn't like, I don't know. At least that was my perspective. Like, it was just a very like cold movie.
Yeah. Like, and that's the thing. I mean, it sounds like it had no emotional weight at all. Right.
Yeah. I mean, like, and they tried to have it, or they tried to make it have like emotional weight. Like there is like one part that does sort of make you care, mm-hmm. but the characters don't seem like they're that interested in it.
Right.
And, I don't know. It's like sometimes stuff just happens and you're just left being like, wait, what was that about? Like,
yeah.
And like they took scenes from like the, from the show, like, I guess I can give this one away because it's not really like a spoiler. It's just more of like a weird, like, huh, why did that happen? Like they have the, you know, like the guys who are driving around the garbage truck.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Those guys are in the movie too. But, they didn't put in the, like, you remember how there was the dude that was like the gunman who was ahead of them, who was like loading up all the traps loading up the hacks for them ahead of time.
Yeah.
Like that dude is not in the movie. What they did instead was they had, the garbage men get hacked and then they become the gunmen. But it's weird because they go from being garbage men to like gun toting gunmen, like instantly. Like in the stretch of like one scene, they go from driving the garbage truck to being like, oh, now they're carrying like Uzis and they're like shooting like the it's weird. And even the characters commented on it. They were like, where did you guys get those guns? And they're like, we don't know. Like, it's like,
we just had them in our hands.
The prop department.
Yeah, it's not like the Matrix where it's like, oh, okay, like we just downloaded some guns. Like,
yeah.
In this one, it's just like, oh, like there's something here. Like, where did these guys get these guns? Like, unless there's like, oh, hold on, there's a gun like vending machine right there. I got this. I got.
So they had to line up with their credit cards to get the guns out.
Yeah. Yeah. I was imagining it's like a Coke machine. Like someone's like, one of them's like down low and he's like sticking his hand through the thing, like trying to get one for free.
And pulls all the Uzi.
Yeah. It's like, ha ha.
The Uzi get. Yeah. You got to pay twice. There's another vending machine for the ammunition cartridge.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm going to wait for that one to be a DVD movie, really. I'm not going to go and watch it in the cinemas.
Yeah, and like I don't want to like I don't know if anybody's who's listening to this is like I don't know, like my opinion is my opinion. I don't state my opinions as fact. Like these are just things that I perceive, but like I don't want to stop anyone from watching the movie. It's more just like, I don't know, it just like as a person, like I went into the movie with like zero expectations because I prefer to do it that way. Because there are so many times I go into a movie and I'm expecting it to be great and then it's not great, you know, or vice versa. Like I'll go in and be like, oh, this movie's going to suck. And then I come out like that movie was awesome. So I found it's just best to go in with like, just like, all right, I'm going to go watch a movie. Like that's it.
And yeah.
And so it served me well up to this point. Like,
yeah. I mean, that's the best way, right? Because then you don't have expectations. And even if it's maybe not great, you're still not super disappointed. So you have a good time.
Yeah. Like, because I've heard people talk about, like, you know, if you go in to see a movie and you're expecting it to be great and it's not, that's such a hard, like, it's way harder to, like, if that's a fall, you know, like, that's a fall from, like, the top of a mountain. Like that's hard to survive. But if you think that something is going to be like nothing and then it ends up being something, like, oh, that's a climb. Like nobody got hurt in the making of this. Like, so I think that that's the, at least for me, especially when it comes to like things like stuff adapted from comics, is like, it's so easy to like the comic version sort of dwarf everything else.
Yeah.
In terms of like the adaptation. But like, to me, I'd rather see something, cause I mean, a movie and a comic are so different. I mean, with all the stuff that they have in common, like, they have even more so things that are different, you know, and things that work out well on a page. If you try to, you know, if they took a comic fight scene and they tried to animate it, like, or put it in a movie, it would be the most boring fight ever, because like, it's really hard to draw like an exciting fight scene in a comic, because the characters aren't moving. You have to convey so much about the motion and the impact in a comic that like, you can feel it. So, you know, like it'd be like seeing a Jackie Chan movie and versus like me trying to draw like a Drunken Master or like any Jackie Chan movie. Like, it's just not going to be as good, you know? So I always try to like take everything with a grain of salt and like, let it be its own version. Like, I would have been perfectly happy with Ghost in the Shell if they had just said, all right, we're going to do a movie in the Ghost in the Shell world with all this lore, but we're not going to have it be about the Major. We're going to have it be about somebody else. That would, like, to me, that would have been perfect. Like, if it was like, oh, this is section two, and here is a thing where they're dealing with, like, with these group of people. Or if they were going to have the Major, like, if they, like, no, we have to have the Major. Okay, well, how about you do something that's not the first animated movie only? Like, how about you have them like they could have come up with anything, but like there was just so many moments in the movie where I was like, okay, we built this movie to sort of get you to this scene and that scene, and like, oh, here's the scene where she's like standing on the thing and she's pulling on it, like trying to like pull the hatch off the tank. It's like, oh, okay. Oh, here's this scene where like you get to see like a, I don't know, this, like, oh, it's the fight in the, in like that water area where like you can't be her. Yeah. And it's just like, okay. But if you guys had done something new, then this would be, then there wouldn't be this like sort of this comparison having to be drawn.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just like sort of going from that scene to scene to scene that comes out of the comics with like just the barest piece of thread of story trying to sort of tie everything together. Which is effectively how I felt with the Zack Snyder movie, you know, and Batman v Superman and stuff. So, there was some great scenes. There was some great sort of imagery that you were like, wow, you know, I can see that in the comic page. But, you know, the story that sort of ties it all together was, it was threadbare, effectively.
Well, like for me, like it was just so obvious to me that, because like Zack Snyder can tell a story. I think that the problem with like the Batman v Superman stuff is just that like they're trying to get to Justice League way too quickly. Like the sort of like the saving grace of the Marvel movies was that they worked their way up to the Avengers like slowly. It took them a while, but they got to it. And when they got to it, it was like, okay, here's your payoff. Like they got to the fireworks. Yeah. But like with Batman v Superman, like it felt like the only movie before this, like the start of their universe, is Man of Steel, and then the second movie is a team up movie. Like already it's a team up, and then the third movie is Suicide Squad, which is like another team up, and then the next movie will be Wonder Woman, and then another team up. Like it's just like they're trying to get to like that billion dollar movie franchise like way quickly.
It feels like they're in a race, but you know, who are they racing against? Because it doesn't have to be a race, which is the thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Superman and Batman individually should be able to generate a $1 billion movie. So, you know, it's not like they need to do that to get there.
Oh yeah. Well, and like, I think that, I mean, cause like with the Christopher Nolan movies, like by the second movie, there was a $1 billion movie. And I think the third one, came up like pretty close to it too. Yeah. So like, yeah, Batman will generate money. And like, even with Man of Steel, like they made a lot of money on Man of Steel. Like it was not like a failure, like by any means. I think it's more like I think it's the producers are like they would rather have it sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
And why else would they like go for like, oh, okay, like, you know, they're I don't know. I see so much like they're looking across the field and seeing like, oh, Marvel's got their like ragtag group of like superheroes. Okay, well, we'll do that. And then it's Suicide Squad, which is like their Guardians of the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. But, like, I see it happening, like, just to be fair, I see it happening on the Marvel camp too, just because like Thor 2 was so not good.
Yep.
Yep.
At least like to me, that like they're like, okay, we have to do a Thor movie again. It's been a while. How can we make it cool? What's doing well for us now? Oh, okay, Guardians of the Galaxy. Okay, let's just do that. Yeah, it's a lot of cribbing right now, which like I'm not super excited about.
Yeah.
What made the Marvel movies, like the Phase 1 ones, cool was because like what made them cool to me was that they were like an anthology. It was like, oh, look, here's a fantasy movie in your superhero movie universe. Here's your fugitive movie. Here's your World War II documentary movie set in the same universe. And that was awesome. But ever since the Avengers, it feels like they've just been doing Avengers over and over. Like,
yeah.
There's no buildup. You know what I mean? Like, Ultron came out of nowhere. I mean, like, we still haven't seen Thanos. Like, how many years has it been since Avengers when they showed his, like, his weird chin at the end of the movie?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's been, like, seven years since that.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And, like, someone commented, like, because there was the casting that, like, Josh Brolin is going to be Cable. Someone was like, oh, like, how is he going to film Thanos if he's going to be Cable? And I'm like, it's been 7 years. Like,
yeah,
if they haven't filmed anything yet, then like they're in trouble.
And I mean, visually, he's going to look very different anyway. It's going to be a purple CGI character. So
yeah. It's not like he's been sitting like at home, like, I don't know, like eating steaks and doing push-ups in order to get to that like Thanos physique.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous. But like, yeah, I mean, at the very least, he'll be doing like the voice work. But I mean, he's not really like an action hero. Well, I don't know. I guess I haven't seen a ton of his movies to guess. But like, if you're gonna have a fight scene with Thanos, would it be better to like hand over the motion capture stuff to
Ray Park or something?
One of those guys, like somebody who knows martial arts, or I guess depending on how they do the fighting, you know, someone who, you know, like if they're going to have him fight with an axe, why don't you give it to somebody who is like a trained stuntman who knows how to fight with an axe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why would you give it to Josh Brolin, who doesn't maybe know how to fight with an axe? But I don't know. I didn't see him with an axe in True Grit. So I can't say.
Yeah.
If he's able to fight with an axe, I don't want him to, like, it's going to be that Vin Diesel movie where Vin Diesel comes to beat me up and like Josh Brolin comes in. He's like, here, I'm here to help, Vin. And I'm like, oh man.
that's a team up I'd like to see.
It's like, you love the Avengers. You love Batman v Superman. Apparently now the next team up movie, Josh Brolin, Vin Diesel versus the George.
Yeah. The George. I love it.
Yeah. Who is the George? He's a nerd with the internet and a big mouth. Someone's got to shut him up.
Now that justice is never going to come. Don't worry.
It's never going to dawn on you.
I hope if they do make that into a movie, I want to be CG. Like, I don't want to be played by an actor. I want it to be like the cheapest movie possible. Like, I want like PlayStation 1 graphics George. It's like walk.
You want to be 8-bit?
Yeah. It's like, wouldn't that be the like the coolest thing? Like watching me, like, and I've even got like a little like sound effect when I run, like, like as I'm running away from Vin Diesel and Josh Brolin as they're smashing up my house.
And for some reason, Josh Brolin is carrying an axe.
Yeah, I'd watch it. And it's not
because... I want to see that poster. That's gonna be an awesome looking poster.
Yeah, the marketing campaign will be amazing for that movie.
Especially if, like, they don't say, and he's an 8-bit character. Like, if it's just there and they don't explain it, like, it's just like, no, this is just this world. George is just an 8-bit character. He looks like the worst sprite in Legend of Zelda 2. The Zelda that nobody talks about.
Just go with it.
But then we already got the Scott Pilgrim movie.
You know what? I haven't seen that. Like, I've heard people say it's great, but, like, I was not a fan of the comic. So not I'm just then. Like, eh. Yeah, I just didn't really watch it. But, like, did you guys like it?
Not the movie is not my cup of tea either.
Really? I enjoyed the movie, I gotta say. It had its faults, but I liked what they were trying to do with it, and I thought it was a really, really good take and a really good interpretation of the comic as well. So,
okay, because like I do like Edgar Wright, and I think more so than anything, like I think that because like the reason I did like Scott Pilgrim when I tried reading it is just the fact that like Scott is kind of a jerk, like he dates this girl. Just to do it, because he's like, oh, she was really cute, so I wanted to date her. And then immediately is like, whoa, look at this girl on roller skates. I know, I'm going to start a relationship up with her instead of, like, I don't know, dealing with his relationship with the first girl who is still, like, smitten with him. And then, like, we're supposed to think he's really heroic when he's fighting against her evil exes. It's like, what about your evil current boyfriend? Who is like two timing with other people and like is and but we're supposed to be having fun. Like it just felt like, I don't know, especially in the first book where like the first like 3/4 of it are just like sort of a typical romance story, like mm-hmm. romantic drama.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, the art style is cutesy. I guess that's where like a lot of the like goofy imagery stuff comes from. But then by the end of it, it's like it's a musical. And there's like video game references. Like it just felt so out of nowhere.
Yeah.
At least based on what people have told me for the movie is that the movie is a little bit more cohesive.
The movie is. It's a lot more tonally consistent.
Yeah.
I mean, what I got out of the story is that, yeah, he is a bit of a dick, but it's kind of like the story of a guy learning how to deal with, he's effectively growing up, you know, learning how to deal with these relationships and, you know, how to deal with other people as well, and his own self-confidence. So that's why I actually did like the story, because I thought that was an interesting story to tell. And the way the movie portrayed that, I thought it did it quite well.
Okay. Yeah, no, I'll give it a try then. Because, like, I'm always looking for new stuff to watch, and I do like Edgar Wright's, like, movie, like, his style of making movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though, like, at times I feel like his movies tend to be a little overwrought, like, especially like, I'm the one I'm thinking of. Like, I love, what's the one where it's the same two dudes, Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, and like they're cops, Hot Fuzz.
Hot Fuzz,
yeah, Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, like Hot Fuzz is like such a fun movie, but like there's a whole like 30 minutes that they could have cut out of that movie and it would have felt a lot better, I think. Like it sort of just goes on for a bit.
He does get self-indulgent sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not gonna lie. I've definitely done stuff in comics, and you'll see it in Spencer and Locke where someone's probably like, I mean, why did he do this? And it's probably because I was like, I just really wanted to. You know, like, I think like in artists, especially in like movies, like sometimes you'll find stuff in there where you're just like, why would this person do that? But then you end up like, if you watch enough of their work, you're like, oh, this is their thing. Okay. Yeah. It's sort of like how, what's that guy? He's the director of Seven.
David Fincher.
Him, for example, his thing in making movies is he likes to make people feel uncomfortable. So if you're watching a movie that he makes and you're not feeling uncomfortable, then he's sitting at home going like, ah, I missed one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so hard for me to say that I like his movies, because I kind of don't. Like, they're so uncomfortable that like just watching them is like, oh, like it almost feels like do I have to?
It's like going to the dentist.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, You know, you got to, and I have to go to a dentist tomorrow.
No,
oh, great. Sorry to bring that up. Then,
yeah, no, it's good. I needed, just like a Fincher movie. Like I needed to do it. Well, yeah, like I remember watching Gone Girl and being like, oh, why did I watch this? This was a poor choice.
But as you've mentioned earlier, perhaps you get people with some of the stuff that seems self-indulgent to others, and other people see it as a valid part of your work that they enjoy. You know, they go to the Fincher movies because they want to feel uncomfortable. Some of his audience.
Yeah, no, yeah, I definitely agree with that. It's sort of like going to a horror movie.
Yeah,
and like not want, but you like don't like to be scared, yeah. Kind of thing.
Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I 100% agree with you.
But you need it from time to time. Just like the dentist.
Yeah. You know, that is a good point. Because, like, you know, sometimes you need to be, like, shaken out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
So that way you can sort of, like, go back to, like, being a normal person.
Yeah. Kind of. And I mean, and that's how you grow as well, right? You got to hopefully expose yourself in a safe way, which is what media allows you to do, to these types of experiences. So I enjoy doing it. It's not comfortable, but I like going to horror movies and just to sort of see how far I can go sometimes.
Yeah.
Like the new It trailer freaked me out. I saw It when I was a kid, and I hate clowns to this day. So I'm looking forward to the new movie coming out and sort of trying to do some exposure therapy to get me to go see it.
So yeah, like when I was a kid, like, so my name is technically Jorge, but my mom calls me Georgie. Or she calls me G, like for short. And right. So like the first kid that gets eaten by the clown in It is named Georgie. And that messed me up as a kid. I thought that clown was coming for me. Cause like back then I didn't have like the biggest grasp that like I was safe from the creature.
Yeah.
Like to me, like movies and stuff was just like, oh, this is just like, this is like somebody was recording this and it's actually happening. So I thought that there was a clown that was like out to get me. And so I was terrified of sewers for the long time until the Ninja Turtles. And I was like, okay.
Well, if they're down there too,
can't be that bad.
Yeah. At least if I get attacked, like they'll come and save me. But like, I feel like it is like the worst pair up of like things to be horrified. Cause like, if you don't like clowns and you don't like bugs, then like it is just like the perfect like monster for you. Because like, I don't know too many people who are like, man, my favorite thing is when I wake up covered in bugs.
Yeah.
Like I love that feeling. Like, I don't know. I feel like I can't imagine it like being more horrifying.
Yeah. It's a pretty primal, like it really preys on the primal fears that people have, you know.
Yeah
I mean, clowns as primal as it gets, I guess, but you know, just any sort of grotesque sort of facial figure.
Yeah, especially when like, because with a clown, like you're looking at it and it looks like a human, but its face is doing something that's not right. Yeah. And just like something in your mind, like it makes you wonder, like, when were clowns cool?
Yeah.
Cause clowns feel like such a weird relic. And then you end up like, you look, wait, but who thought clowns were a good idea? I guess back when, like, in the silent era, maybe like mime, like clown was like extension of mime.
Yeah.
But like at the same time, like, ugh. Do you guys watch True Facts about animals?
No.
It's this YouTube series. Like the only reason I bring it up is because it's like tangentially related. This guy, he does these like short, like little nature documentaries about real animals and their weird habits, but he like punches them up to be funny. And so he was talking about the mantis shrimp, which if you've ever seen it, like it's just like it's got these like crazy colors and it's really violent, and like apparently like it some of them have these like these on their legs, like some of them have these like fists that are so they can punch things with so much force that they can actually generate light, and they have like, I think it said like it has like the same firepower as like a 22 caliber bullet. And like this thing is like, it could fit in your hand. Like it's not like a big creature. It's this like little shrimp, and like, it's, And so the dude kept comparing it to a clown. He was saying like, oh, the mantis shrimp is a living fossil of the prehistoric clown that all clowns like evolved from.
Wow.
And then like later on, he's saying like, and just like the clown, the mantis shrimp is a psychopathic killer.
Who can generate. At
the end of the video. Yeah, it's great. Like at the end of the video, he says like, so just remember, if you're afraid of clowns, stay afraid. Stay very afraid. Cause like, oh man, mantis shrimps are crazy, but yeah. So are clowns. So it all works out.
So are clowns. I was gonna say at the end of that video, was it like this video brought to you by the new Warner Brothers movie or whatever?
No, at this point it's a few years old, but like I feel like
all right.
they need that dude needs to make more videos in general. He's really right. Fun.
Yeah.
But I'll stop talking about YouTube videos that I like on your podcast about.
No, I mean. Clearly, we could go on talking to you about pretty much anything at this point because yeah. We're having so much fun. I'm just conscious of time. So,
thank you so much for listening to this episode of Asteroids in Exile. The second part of this interview is already on the feed and ready for your consumption. You'll find links to Jorge's web presences as well as further information about everything that has been mentioned in this episode at our blog at asteroidsinexile.com. And the show notes for this episode. If you want to get in contact with us, you can do so via email at asteroidsinexile@gmail.com or Twitter under the handle asteroidsin or on Instagram at asteroidsinexile. If you like this episode, please consider leaving a rating and or a review on iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice. Take care and you'll hear from us.